Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to End Zone and Falcon Zone Super Hour. I am your host, Jeremy York. Having a blast this week. I hope you guys are too. There are some really cool things we want to get to. We'll have some guests calling in here in a few minutes. I think you guys are going to really enjoy. Some of the things that I want to get to today, are the Dolphins still a mess? They've had a lot of goofy things happen and crazy things going on. How long do some of the top quarterbacks in the league actually have before we think they'll call them quits? A guy who only played 1 year and was pretty good last year is probably going to end up retiring. The Packers have a new system. They're going to use to track the player's development. And as we get into Falcon Zone and everything like that, we got Hard Knocks and the big trade and everything like that. But, like I said, I am your host, Jeremy York, and you are part of Impact Media Presents the Falcon Zone and End Zone Super Hour. And I'm joined once again by the coach, Mr. Haywood Hill. How you doing this week, coach?
I'm great, Jeremy. How about yourself?
Doing spectacular. It's actually been a real good week. You know, I was going over some of the things as we come out of the intro there, and let's just jump right in. As far as one of the bigger topics that I've heard this week, are the Dolphins still a mess? And when I say are they still a mess, it's because of two big injuries that's happened to them that both these guys will have surgery soon, and that's the free agent signing of Knowshon Moreno. I believe he'll have knee surgery, and their center, Pouncey, is going to have hip surgery, I believe you said. Are either of these big enough to actually say that they're still kind of in a little bit of a mess?
Well, right now it's going to be a great task for the head coach to look at his offensive line because they're going to be very young, talented. You know, by far plays an interesting role as a quarterback on the offensive line. I think that's what's going to hurt the most, in my opinion. It depends on how well the backup has been a student of the game and has kind of followed things, so that they're going to kind of be scrambling right there. As far as Mr. Moreno is concerned, I don't know about Knowshon's. Where they have him placed. I mean, you know, he signed only a one-year deal. They've kind of struggled at that position. I think it's still wide open for them. So I think Pouncey's situation being out and on the sideline pretty much the rest of the year versus, you know, Knowshon coming back and being prepared right at preseason, it depends on how well the surgery goes with him. Can he come in and be the workhorse and take a lot of pressure off the line? With all those young guys on the line. And with that also being said, what type of role does Pouncey play in passing that torch, at least for this year, in that situation with his surgery and being out for the rest of the year?
Yeah, I agree here that Knowshon Moreno, especially, you know, they didn't have him last year, so it's kind of hard to say. We don't know what he would have done this year, but hopefully he rebounds from his injury. But, yeah, it's – Pouncey is the only guy left on that offensive line from last year, and so now they're going to start five brand-new starters. And if you're not sure how important a center is, simply look at the performance of Manny Ramirez during the Broncos Super Bowl game, and we see exactly how big the center position is.
I also like to add to that too, Jeremy, if you want to talk about productivity, let's look at Jeff Saturday for all the years that he was with the Colts.
Right.
And also, you have to take in consideration as a side note to this is that Mr. Pouncey still had the NFL situation to deal with the bullying.
Correct.
That took place down there. So even if it wasn't an injury situation, what is the impact still left, and the residue from that particular situation was already pending prior to the injury?
Yeah, that's true, because, you know, regardless of how long he had this injury, Roger Goodell still yet to really weigh in on that whole thing. But as we move on, Peyton Manning was quoted early last week, quote, "Retirement is not really on my radar," unquote. Now, we could sit here and debate all day long about if we actually believe him or not, but, you know, any player is always thinking about that big R word. But this brought up the thing to me, you know, how long of a shelf life, how long in their careers do, you know, four of the top, we could sit here and debate them all, but I just picked four of the top quarterbacks in the league, and we'll kind of quickly go over how long we think they have left. And that's Peyton Manning, that's Tom Brady, that's Drew Brees, and as a wild card, because nobody seems to like to talk about him, I threw in Carson Palmer.
Okay, let's start with Peyton Manning. I think that two things are happening. One, I call it the Brett Favre syndrome, no pun intended. He'll go year in and year out on whether or not he wants to retire, whether or not he wants to play, how his body is holding up. It's all exciting when you're getting ready to go right back into the next year, especially after the season they came off of. I think that he probably has maybe two max. I think his contract runs out in 2016. He has always been a person that seems to honor those type of things. So I think he plans up to 2016. So I'm going to give him those 2 years. The next quarterback that you mentioned, and I didn't catch the rundown because it was late. Give me the next quarterback, please.
It was Tom Brady.
Tom Brady. Tom Brady still has at least 3 to 5 years left in him. I think he proved that with what they went through last year with all of the injuries, he can play with anybody, especially in that system that they have. But I think that he probably will start looking at it within the next 3 years on whether or not he wants to look at an additional two. So I'm only going to give him about three as well.
Right. And Drew Brees was next.
Drew Brees has a lot to prove, especially after what the Saints had gone through. I think that he will be pushing more so, toward the 4-year, 5-year range. He's been healthy. He's not had, you know, anything major go wrong with him. He likes where he is and with the Saints. And I think that there's some time still left as they're developing, redeveloping the Saints to make a push for the Super Bowl again. So I think that he has I think I'm looking at him at 4 to 5, realistically.
Yeah, I think so. And then, like I said, I threw in the wild card because he didn't get a lot of mention. Carson Palmer.
Well, Mr. Palmer is just going to, again, it's going to depend on the situation, the contract, the money, injuries. But right now, I would say probably another 3 years with him as well, just a base 3 years.
Right. Yeah, for the most part, I agree with you. These guys have right around 2 to 3. I actually give Peyton one more year. I think he's done after this year regardless. But, you know, only time will tell on that. And I don't even know if I want to mention it on the show, but I guess I will now that I've brought it up. I've actually been quoted recently as saying that there's a small part of me that thinks Tom Brady may not play his last game for the Patriots. I actually think he could finish with another team.
Well, that'd be interesting to see. I think that the way their system, the infrastructure of their salary caps and how they do such a great job in making sure that they can keep quality players there will just tell over time. I think that if he really wants to get out of New England fast, all he has to do is go in and ask for money, i.e. Wes Welker. It gives you a quick example of what happens. So time will tell. It depends on, you know, where he wants to be. You know, where he wants to be. Does he want to finish his career there? Does he want to change his scenery. I think it would really be up to Mr. Brady to determine whether or not he finishes as a quarterback there, as a franchise quarterback there with the Patriots.
Yeah, I definitely agree there. And you know, all signs, probably 99% say that he'd stay there. But moving on to those Green Bay Packers, it was kind of sad news in a way that running back Jonathan Franklin, who had a pretty good year last year, I mean, he was really making some good waves. After, I believe it was neck surgery or a big neck injury he had, he was released by the team earlier this week or earlier last week. And he's actually cleared waivers. There's a good chance that, you know, if he doesn't get a deal soon, and I don't even know if he's seeking one, that he could actually retire. And this is just kind of a, you know, the whole thing is running backs usually have a shelf life of an average of 3 years, and as talented as this kid was, it looks like, you know, his story could be over after one.
Well, unfortunately, that's, you know, that's kind of the nature of the beast. If you look at the life expectancy, and I use that term loosely with players in the NFL, it's only about 3.5 years. And anybody gets beyond that, you know, you've done pretty good, especially if you have not sustained a career ending or some type of major injury that requires surgery for a season-ending situations. The upside is that he's young and his body probably can recover fast, especially if he's already cleared waivers. Downside is what coach or what organization wants to take a risk on it right now that soon. That's where the problem is going to come in. How the money is structured, what timing that they will be willing to bring him in and look at him against the players that they have. And as we've mentioned in some segments of the show previously, the running back position is being questioned now. You know, I mean, how relevant are these guys becoming? They are relevant. They are a big, huge part of the game. But now you have to do so many more things now. And do they already feel that they have that in their organization as far as, you know, how well you block and all these other things. I think the neck injury, you know, somehow, some way, he's going to have to try to find a way into camp so he can prove that under the helmet he still can play and the injury hasn't affected him no more than what it did as far as the surgery is concerned. That. But the question is who's going to take the chance right now. And so his agent, you know, I'm sure is having a lot of short days and long nights trying to figure out, you know, what would be the best opportunity for him.
Right. And then as we kind of transition to another team that may be a little closer to your heart, the Pittsburgh Steelers announced that they're going to start, or they're going to at least be the first guinea pigs to use these new helmets and the new technology in these helmets. What have you heard about this?
Well, I had an opportunity to look at Schultz's video that they have on this particular technology. I think personally right now where it is in its infancy, it is great for pop. That's no pun intended against or trying to disrespect their product in any kind of way. I want to make that clear up front. But right now, when you look at the actual video, you understand more of what I'm saying. You have to actually go on the website, look at the video. They are doing like a high school scrimmage or a typical practice, and you see what they would like to do with it, and they actually make some comments of what a coach can see. But you'd have to freeze frame a lot of this. It's real shaky right now. There's nothing that stabilizes what you actually see. You see it in live time. You see it in real time. So once they can get a way to get some type of panoramic view where you can see beyond where the player is or what is just directly in front of them, just as a tilt or a swivel of their helmet, once they can get that under control, I think it can be very beneficial because you can see a lot of as it moves quicker, and you can catch it in real time versus trying to go back and manipulate it with the film.
Right, and you know, that's another thing. It's not who makes it; it's making it safer and everything. And we do need to protect the children and show them the right way from really reinventing the wheel, so to say, with the new helmets on the pro level.
I agree.
And as we one of the things we're going to actually close with this, but switching back to the Packers have this new GPS-based system that they're going to use to track a player's workload. Have you heard anything about this?
I have. As a matter of fact, there's a company in Australia that has been working on perfecting this type of system for over a decade. As a matter of fact, their football players there in Australia have been using it for over 10 years. That's been very beneficial because now when you're talking about cold climate teams, Green Bay, Chicago, these type of teams, and other teams as well, you're looking at your regiment now. As a coach, we will become very comfortable with our regiment, and it's very hard for us to change our regiment. If you start out with jogging 20 minutes and start progressing up, sometimes you can overtrain, but I think preparation in that training most definitely is a key role in you having an edge over your opponent. So I think this technology gives them an opportunity to see where they need to probably pick some things up or slow some things down. So I think by far this them having this technology, and they actually use it in practice. So what I like about what Green Bay is doing with this is the fact that they did not force it onto the team, and more especially onto the players. The players had some long conversations with the company that's doing this, and we're excited about getting some of this in so they can see their own productivity. So it can play also in, you know, in the weight of, you know, reducing injuries. Now, Green Bay was one of the top four teams in the league over probably the last 3 years with major injuries or a lot of injuries to their players. For them, it's going to be a great advantage. It gives them all of the information moving forward with this type of technology.
You know, and as we close end zone and get ready for to talk Falcons here in a few minutes, with all these new testing, you know, the plate force test that the Jags and Falcons are using, we get into another one, the NeuroTracker, here in a little while that the Falcons are using as well. The Steelers have the new helmets they're working on. The Packers have the GPS system. With all these new tests out here, you know, how results were after on making the game safer and better?
Well, football is becoming more and more of a science. As you look at all of the things are applied, physics, a lot of stuff that's there now already, they're just now, we now have the technology that can keep up with the things that are being done. And now you can justify a lot of this stuff. So I think I welcome the technology. I think it will grow over time. I think it reduces the injuries over time. It changes the dynamics of how you practice and what you'll be practicing moving forward. I think the basis of football is the foundation, and the fundamentals will always be there. This gives you just those extra tools to be able to look at a situation and or look at a player and say, what are the things, what do we need to do to maximize the best opportunity to use that particular player's or player's abilities. So I think the technology is wonderful. I think it's coming along slowly, but over time I think it'll be something that you'll see just throughout the league and not just football. I think you're going to find it all of the major sports.
Yeah, definitely so. And I see we have our guest lined up coming up here soon. So as we head into the break, we got a lot of good stuff coming up on the Falcon Zone. Like I said, we will talk about the recent releases and trades and that NeuroTracker test. But we'll see you guys on the other side of the break. Jeremy, the Impact York from Endzone here. Would you or your business like to advertise with Endzone? It's easier than you think. With many packages available, we've got the perfect deal to help you promote your business to a whole new audience. All you have to do is contact us at 3endzone@gmail.com for more info and to get started today. Let us help you grow your business. Hi, Jeremy the Impact York here from Mellow Mushroom. Are you looking for a great family-friendly restaurant with food that is great and healthy? Drop by the Mellow Mushroom. They use the freshest ingredients to make everything on their amazing menu. Pizzas, calzones, salads, and more, plus daily drink specials. Go to mellowmushroom.com to find the location nearest you. Hey, Zoners, it's Jeremy the Impact York. Are you looking for a dinner full of flavor with a little kick? Then Tequila Mexican Restaurant is your destination for authentic Mexican food and drinks. Make sure to come by on the weekends for live music on the patio and bring all your friends for a good time. With locations in Dallas and Hiram, they are ready to dish out their great food and more. Wow, I really think I could listen to that song all day long. Welcome to the Falcon Zone. I am your host, Jeremy York, joined once again by the coach, Mr. Haywood Hill.
Hi, Jim.
And as I said, we do have our special guest lined up. So without further ado, why don't we go on and bring him on? He had joined us once before, but we're always glad to have him back. Please help us welcome Mr. Harper LaBelle.
Jeremy, how are you? Haywood, good to see you again.
It's great to hear from you, Harper.
It's always good to have you on. Been a couple weeks since we had you on the show and everything. What's been going on?
Well, I have to admit, guys, we're in that calm, still portion, kind of the eye of the hurricane, in between the end of the season, the draft, and getting ready for everything else that's going. This is the quiet time. This is where you get to take a deep breath, enjoy yourself. There's no fantasy football yet. You don't have to worry about your draft and picking teams, but camp will be starting in about a month, so it'll all be picking up here. I hope you enjoy the Braves or watch the NBA draft or whatever it is that tickles your fancy, but we still have a little bit of time before they start doing it for keeps.
Yeah, definitely. Even the players and a lot of other people I know in the media have decided to go check out who has the fruitiest drink with an umbrella in it.
Yep, you get to enjoy a little bit of vacation, probably visit family if you've got some that are in different parts of the country, or have them visit you. Go to the amusement park, whatever it is, enjoy your summer, go to the beach, do whatever you do, but then right around about a week after the 4th of July, put all that stuff away because it's time to play for keeps right after that.
Yeah, definitely so. And since you mentioned training camp, the Falcons released their training camp schedule the other day to where there's a handful of dates starting in late July where if they're open to the public, and if you guys want to go check out the Falcons players and get up close and really see what this team's about this year and, you know, maybe even possibly be on Hard Knocks. You can go to their website. They list out all the different times and dates. And I don't know if you need to register, but they got all that information on there. But as we said before the break, the Falcons are right on top of all this new technology. They have a new test on top of the force plate test they've been using. This one is the NeuroTracker test. Have you heard anything about this?
Just a little. I think the thing about it is if there's something that can help either prevent or help to study injuries to try to prevent them or to at least figure out how to make them less impactful, not only in the short-term occurrence of the injury, if there is one, but for future reference and the long-term health of the players, I'm all for it. Let's see what we can do. If it's just an experiment, we're going to see. Then let's look at the technology and see how we can fine-tune it to make it better.
Yeah, definitely. And basically, for the people who aren't familiar with the NeuroTracker test, it is a 3D mental training program that increases the player's awareness and focus. And so they're really trying to – what it does, it kind of breaks down sometimes almost to the effect of why a player decided to go left to make a play as opposed to going right, or it just really breaks down kind of the neurotransmitters in the head. And Coach Hill, from a coaching standpoint, what would you really use this to look for in a player?
Well, I'm going to look for the tendencies of the player. If the player continues to go left, if the play goes right, but his first step is left, you want to get that information and figure out what the player actually is seeing and or thinking at that time. A lot of football is played unconsciously, so the only time we get a chance to correct a lot of that stuff is in practice, and then more importantly, we see it on film. So now if you have this information, just the next step piece of the process, it can be very advantageous in when you sit and talk with the players over grade, whatever it may be, or even that play, what they were actually thinking if you have the data to prove it.
Yeah, definitely so. And, you know, this just goes back to what we were saying during the end zone segment, where it's just another set of technology. And as far as I know, the Falcons, I don't know that they're exclusive, but they're the first team to actually use this. And with all this new testing and everything like that, it's like they're trying to prove to everybody that last year's record is not reflective of the overall performance and talent of this team.
Yeah, I agree. I think that right now they're in a situation where they're looking at making sure that they maximize everything they have available to them to this season.
And Harper, did they have any kind of way to try to gauge things like this back when you played?
Boy, there was just some beginning technology where, not of course on the field, but in a studio type environment, there used to be a test that would track your speed. You'd be on a platform, let's say, and there were sensors around it, and there were lights in front of you, and there would be a light that would be green or red, and they would flash certain lights, green to the left, that means you step with your left foot, and they would measure how quickly you could get your foot off the ground, take a step, and get your foot back on the ground in the direction that you were asked to go. The reason for that was just to see who was quicker, who was faster, and how you could possibly improve that. If you're a linebacker or if you're a defensive back, having somebody that you know is faster than somebody else, but not only that, but can make decisions quicker, that would be the technology that was available just in its infancy around the time that I was done. But I think they're taking it to a different level. And as Coach said, to kind of piggyback off that, if you have the ability as a coach or even a player to realize that I'm X speed, I'm this fast, but I can work to make it even quicker, to make my decisions faster, then it would only improve your abilities on the field is what I would think, and make you more valuable in a number of different ways.
Yeah, definitely so. And you know, it wasn't that long ago that you played, so it's kind of come a long way in a short amount of time.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the experimentation from the Olympic level or from NASA that's being deferred down into professional sports and even at the high school ranks. There's people that are doing things at the high school level that are light years ahead of where I was when I was there. So anything that can improve or enhance your abilities, and if it helps you get one more win or five more wins a year, then I think everybody's all for it as long as it's cost effective.
Yeah, definitely so. And as we move on to probably the biggest Falcon news in the past week, the big trade that sent linebacker Akeem Dent, former Georgia Bulldog, but sent him to Houston Texans for quarterback T.J. Yates. You know, on the surface, a lot of people kind of didn't understand the move, but, you know, what were you guys' take from this?
Well, from a coach's perspective, obviously they felt that they needed to look at the position, and they looked at where they felt they maybe had a surplus. So I think the move with Atlanta is looking at, in case something was to happen at that position, they feel comfortable with what they've been able to bring in right now to play behind the person that has it now, which is Matt Ryan. So I think the move out of Atlanta, I think it was an insurance policy.
Yeah, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I think, and I kind of tease that the Falcons drafted about 42 linebackers and brought in some others. So there was some depth at the position that when you take a guy like Akeem, as much as you like him, if you look at the cap value and then the amount of competition around him that would possibly be able to make the team. And the first impression that you have from some of those guys that came in as either free agents or draft picks or guys that you signed during the offseason from other clubs, evidently there was enough to make him available for a one-on-one trade. And as much as people like Dominique Davis, and shame to see him go, but you're getting a guy in TJ that's not only played, but played pretty well. And heaven forbid if anything happens to Matt Ryan, you've got a quality backup that's kind of proven himself in a position that you don't really have right now. So I think you added some depth at the quarterback position, and you already have some depth at linebacker, so that trade seemed like pretty much a no-brainer to me.
Well, and as I kind of told a lot of Falcons fans, and they initially kind of chirped back at me about it, but when I explained what I meant by it, they kind of understand it more. In adding T.J. Yates, you double the amount of playoff wins that you've had in this regime in one shot, and that's no shot at Matt Ryan, but his one playoff win is great, but T.J. Yates has also won a game where he stepped in for, I believe, Matt Schaub, who was injured at the time. So now, not only is it that depth, but here's a guy who can play when the game's on the line and you feel comfortable, you know, with him with the ball.
And that's, to me, only going to make things even better for him during practices and during 2 days. He's going to try to do everything he can. Nothing against anybody else, but, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're on the Atlanta Falcons and you're a quarterback right now, you're looking up at a list of guys that at the very top of that list is Matt Ryan, and you're going to try to play, and you're going to try to do everything you can to get on the field and make an impression and stick around as long as you can. And, you know, TJ may be a guy that comes in and does a fantastic job and may sit for a year or two or three, or he may, because of an injury, go in from week one. We don't know. But I think you're right in that if you prove what you're capable of doing from the Houston perspective and then add to that when you come to Atlanta, I think it's a win-win situation for the Falcons' depth.
And as you mentioned, this trade did cause Dominique Davis, at the time, the backup quarterback to Matt Ryan, to be released. And Coach Hill, I want to kind of throw this towards you because you had spoken to me off the air many times. You had gotten to see Dominique Davis on more of a scouting level, on different levels that we didn't see. All we saw was the handful of experience he may get, 5 minutes here or two snaps there. Is this guy going to land on his feet, or is he going to have a little bit of trouble trying to catch on somewhere?
I don't think he's going to have any trouble catching on. I thought he's a very good athlete. He has a very strong arm. I think the only thing that he lacks is just the experience. I was a little puzzled over the last couple of years that he's been there that Atlanta didn't find some type of way of getting him on the field. I think his situation was just timing. I think last year he played against Miami, if I'm not mistaken, in a game, and you saw a different dynamic in the offense. The dynamic of the offense changed because he can extend plays with his feet. And again, like I said, I think the only thing he lacks is just the ability to rep with the offense more in a live game situation. Now, practice is one thing. I mean, practice you can make it perfect if necessary. However, practice is only going to give you so much. It's not going to give you game speed. So once he gets out here and someone takes a chance on him, I think maybe even Jacksonville would be a good spot for him to go, and or maybe even Carolina if he can land there and be behind a Cam Newton. But the kid most definitely can play. There's no question that his abilities are there. It's just lack of timing on the field.
You know, and as always, and not because of the cookie-cutter answer from us or anything, but we do wish Dominique Davis the best on his future endeavors, and yeah, I believe he's going to land somewhere. He does have a lot of talent, and if you can see tape on him, I encourage you to do so because he is just a ridiculously good athlete. But also things that they were able to sign veteran linebacker Tim Dobbins. Have you guys gotten a chance to check out his body of work?
I can't say that I have. I haven't had a chance to look at him as of yet.
Yeah, I'm going to confer with that. I haven't really done it, but I'm sure that the Falcon front office, the pro personnel directors, and everybody else is really taking into consideration what you would for anybody else. There's really three criteria that become important. One is, is this guy a guy that's going to enhance our team? Is he going to make us better? In other words, is he a player? Is he the type of guy that we would want on our roster? And then you'd ask other coaches that are either on the staff that you have right now or ones that you know and respect, and say, well, what's he like in the locker room? What kind of work ethic does he have? And then obviously if you can sign him, if he has a cap value that is something that you can work with. I mean, we could probably assign Ray Lewis, but it's cost us $8 or $9 million to get him out of his ESPN contract, right? I mean, let's be candid. There are certain people that bring value, and they're available, and they want to be here. So if you get the perfect storm like that, and hopefully there's some incentives for playing time that if he does start and does a great job and leads the team in tackles and proves himself on the field, then by all means, I think that there'll be some incentives to make it worth his while and get a better value for his compensation. So there are a lot of things that you want to consider, but they wouldn't assign him had they not had a lot of criteria that he was able to pass.
Well, I don't know much about most of his body of work. I do know that he's on his fourth team in 9 years, which is not always a bad thing in the league based off free agency and just the way parity is across the league. But besides being an experienced linebacker, he is actually quite good at being a pretty much like the field general during special teams, which the same reason they kind of added Devin Hester. Even though Hester can give you maybe a defensive back look sometimes, and sometimes he can be a wide receiver, you sign Devin Hester to return kicks. Well, they signed Tim Dobbins to help on special teams to kind of fix some of the little odds and ends they have there.
Yeah, and I can speak a little bit about that. Coach, you could probably confirm that those guys are invaluable. You've got everyday players, and generally you want to sit them down and let them get a little rest, because a tired linebacker or a running back or a safety that goes out to cover a punt may make a mental or a physical error because of fatigue. But you get a guy that's fresh off the sideline, and if he knows and understands his role and is able to not only do his job but help the guy next to him on either side do theirs better and be accountable for that, again, there's no price that can be paid for that. And because of the salary cap, a lot of older players that have that type of core mentality, they end up by the wayside because they end up costing too much if they're not a starter. So bringing in a guy like that that can not only play for you if someone gets hurt or fill in on nickel or dime situations, but also be a guy that, you know, on kickoff return or coverage of any kind can be a value there, those guys are hard to come by.
Oh, I agree 100%. I should always say that it takes special people to play special teams. And by far, when you have a player with that type of background that can come in and can help you. And one of the ways I like to explain special teams to players is that it's the first offensive and defensive play. You never look at it like that. But, you know, on a kickoff, that's the first offensive play before the offensive unit actually hits the field. So field positioning by far plays a huge role. And if you have those type of impact players on your special teams, especially when you're getting down to games and how close games can be played, that makes the difference in if your physical kickers are going to be able to make it or not.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Please forgive me. I delayed a little bit, so I apologize for that. I can promise you guys, when I was released by the Falcons, I went to Green Bay, and it was the year that they had just won the Super Bowl. And I cannot tell you how amazed I was to go there and see first, second, maybe a couple third-year players that knew. If I was on the defensive line and I had Sean Jones and Reggie White and Dotson on the – oh, are you kidding me? Gilbert Brown, you know you're not going to play. But you can play on special teams and make an impact and get yourself for 10, 12 plays per game to where you get noticed. And there was just a different mentality there that I saw and really respected. Those guys took their special teams very seriously. Part of that was coaching with Nolan Cromwell. Part of that was the players just owning that part of the game themselves, and it really made a tremendous contribution. I had to play against those guys for a couple years, and I realized how good they were, and then I saw why. Again, it's worth more than gold if you've got a group of guys, not just one or two, but an entire group of guys that really take that aspect of the game, take it seriously, and it can make the difference between you making the playoffs or not in many cases.
Yes, absolutely. And as we go into the real battle that's going on this team, I guess, so far, I mean, with Prince Shimbo moving to the inside, you know, the inside linebacker spot, and there's the outside linebacker spot. But the real competition right now is for the nickelback spot. And, you know, Robert McClain had it last year and had a pretty good 2012. But he's going to have Allen and Southward, the rookies this year, just breathing down his neck. Who do you guys see taking over the nickelback spot?
Well, I think it's early right now to tell, and you won't really be able to tell until once you get into training camp and more, especially once you get to preseason. So I think right now he probably leads it just because of the scheme. But once you get into training camp, I think what I'm seeing the Falcons do this year, I think there's no one safe. So it's just basically going to be how fast the players digest the playbook and continue to perform consistently in the scheme. So it's going to be very interesting to see once they get to training camp and get to probably around the second or third preseason game to see how it starts to pan out.
Yeah, I think that Southward's kind of the barometer and the link there that could make this really a very interesting, I won't call it a battle, but a situation defensively where, let's just say he, because of his size, if he can cover on the outside, because you got to remember now, Tampa, with Mike Evans now, has two guys that are 6'4" or 6'5", in Vincent Jackson and Evans. And if we've got small, what if Southward with his size can cover one of those guys on the outside? And you move Trufant or Alfred in the inside to play that nickel slot because of your depth and you can do so and it doesn't really mess up your defense, it only makes it stronger. Again, that's a depth issue. And I know I'm just throwing things against the wall like that, but there may be some talent that we're not aware of in the secondary and with our linebackers and with the young guys that we have that we're not aware of yet, but we're going to find pretty soon. And you can kind of match up against teams. I mean, can you imagine if Southward can cover Graham from New Orleans down the middle of the field? Because that's been a thorn in the Falcons' sides for about 4 or 5 years. So there's a lot of different scenarios, but I don't know how it's going to pan out today, but I know in about 3 weeks into the preseason, we're going to have a really good idea of what they're going to be doing, and I think that the sky's the limit for how the secondary is going to be able to play.
Well, and Jimmy Graham is also a thorn in the side of New Orleans as well, but that is a completely different topic. But what a lot of people don't realize is no matter what the Falcons say their base defense is, whether they say it's 3-4 or 4-3, if you look at the formation that they use the most times, and I believe it's like 63% of the time, it is the nickel package. And when asked about this, Mike Smith said it's because they face so many 3 and 4 receiver sets that they pretty much just work out of the nickel package.
True. Well, I agree. Yeah, go ahead, Coach.
Yeah, that's exactly why they do it. I mean, I think defenses have to kind of conform. You know, the offense dictates what the defense is put in a position to do unless you catch them off guard. So, again, going back to what Harper said earlier about having Graham coming down the middle, so those type of things are the reason that they're addressing those issues with the type of defense right now.
We got bigger up front. Now, everybody says that we don't have the pass rush yet, and I think that there's still going to be a move, maybe even two, before the regular season. There'll be a guy who's playing defensive end on a club right now that has a lot of depth there that'll get released and let go, and we'll probably pick up or at least attempt to try to bring in one or two of those guys before all is said and done. But if Bierman or Hegman or anybody else can support Osi on the outside, on the other side of the ball, and we get a pass rush, it will drastically change what we're capable of doing. But let's be candid, guys. We couldn't stop the run last year at all. So
no, not at all.
We didn't have to go against a team's goal line offense in order to, you know, have them get a first down. It was obvious. So you could leave your 3-set wide receivers in, or even 4, and still run the ball? Are you kidding? I'd leave them all in, leave my bugs in, and force the Falcons to play outside their comfort zone. So I think that, you know, getting bigger up front, which is exactly what we did, brought in a couple of new guys, and with a few guys getting healthy last year with the draft and free agency, I think our ability to stop the run on third down especially is going to be greatly enhanced and thus change what offenses are doing against us.
Yeah, absolutely. And we got to take a quick break real quick, but as we come back from the break, I'm actually going to pick Harper's brain a little bit. Some few things that I've always wanted to ask, and we'll take your questions as well, but we'll be right back after this.
Jeremy the Impact York here from Mellow Mushroom. Are you looking for a great family-friendly restaurant with food that is great and healthy? Drop by the Mellow Mushroom. They use the freshest ingredients to make everything on their amazing menu. Pizzas, calzones, salads, and more, plus daily drink specials. Go to mellowmushroom.com to find the location nearest you. Jeremy the Impact York from Endzone here. Would you or your business like to advertise with Endzone? It's easier than you think. With many packages available, we've got the perfect deal to help you promote your business to a whole new audience. All you have to do is contact us at 3endzone@gmail.com for more info and to get started today. Let us help you grow your business. Hey Zoners, it's Jeremy the Impact York. Are you looking for a dinner full of flavor with a little kick? Then Tequila Mexican Restaurant is your destination for authentic Mexican food and drinks. Come by on the weekends for live music on the patio and bring all your friends for a good time. With locations in Dallas and Hiram, they are ready to dish out their great food and more. And we are back. As always, try to visit our sponsors and let them know how much you appreciate us being able to come on and talk about the Falcons, let you guys know everything. I am joined by the coach, Mr. Haywood Hill, and also our special guest today, Mr. Harper LaBelle. And before the break, I said that there was some stuff. I had actually been digging around a little bit, and I didn't get the chance to ask you some of this the first time you're on, Harper, but I figured now there's no time like the present. So I had some of your work on the weekends for 92.9 The Game here in Atlanta. I heard you telling the story about being a player representative back when the CBA vote for the first salary cap was. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, sure. If I bore you or put you to sleep, just let me know. You know, hit me in the head before it gets to the point. But I was honored, really. Mike Reuther was, some might remember him, he was Mr. Versatile, a guy that could play tight end and tackle, guard, center. Mike needed some help, so I offered to do so, and next thing you know, both of us were the player reps. And then Mike was let go, and then in 1993, that first year where the cap was voted on, and I kind of did a little research. I knew I didn't know nearly enough, so I talked to some of the other player reps, called them on my own, and just tried to have some one-on-one conversation. What do you think? What's the good, the bad, and the ugly? I spoke to my agent, and he was a guy that was in that Judge Doty case with Reggie White for free agency. He was a guy that had to testify, so I wanted his opinion. I talked to Mark Belanger at the time. He was the executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association. You may remember him as the shortstop for the Baltimore Orioles back in the late 60s and early 70s. And Mark made a very interesting comment to me. Without a doubt, baseball has probably one of the strongest unions of any of the sports, still do today, and they did at that time. And Mark says, listen, we're pulling for you guys for football. We're pulling for you. We want you to get the best possible deal that's out there, because it only helps us. If you get a bad deal, then the owners that we've got are going to say, look at what the football guys got. We've gave you too much. So there's a little bit of a leeway there that I felt responsible for. And I talked to some of the guys on our team, and we felt that it was a good plan, but it wasn't great. It could have been better. And the problem that I saw was that the way the cap was constructed was there were going to be a lot of veteran players were prior to 1993. And, Coach, you can probably confirm this. The older you were, the longer that you played, the higher you were paid, the more you earned. And it's changed since then. Now it's if you're a starter, you get paid more. And that's great. Nobody has a problem with that. But it left with a lot of other guys that had 6, 8, 10, maybe 12 years of experience that were now too expensive and then expendable. The difference between what a rookie was going to make was more than half of what a veteran of 3 or 5 years was going to make. And I just thought that that was a big enough discrepancy to where it would be an easy out for a general manager or a personnel director to be able to say, hey, veteran player, you just make too much money. I can bring in 2 rookies for the same price as you. Bye-bye. And I thought that was an issue that needed to be addressed, so there was no thought given to that or compensation or arrangement in any way, shape, or form that I saw. So I voted no, and I was the only guy that did. I was the only team representing the Falcons of the 30 that were in the league at that time. Jacksonville and Carolina didn't come in until a year and a half later. But there was one team, I think it was Cleveland, that abstained. They voted to not vote, and then everybody, so it was 28-1-1. And the league could not at all say that it was a unanimous decision. I know that they wanted to, and I know the Players Association wanted the same thing, but like I said from the beginning, it was good but not great. And so I stuck to my guns. I had too many guys on my team that I knew that were going to get hurt by it, and before long, probably 3 years afterwards, a lot of those guys weren't around anymore, and that was the great shame that I saw in this great financial package that was supposed to benefit everybody. It ended up letting a lot of my teammates go.
Yeah, and was there any backlash with you being the only no vote?
Not necessarily. I know I got sneered at a little bit by the executive director and a couple other guys, but they understood my opinion, and they won the big deal anyways. I mean, the race to get the collective bargaining agreement passed won overwhelmingly. I mean, again, I'm the only guy, but not necessarily, not on a personal level, not at all. But especially when I gave my opinion and those that cared, that asked about it, they kind of understood. They nodded a little bit, and that makes sense. Maybe I should have reconsidered my vote. But long story short is not too many people gave my particular vote too much attention.
I agree that when you look at what was taking place at that time, anytime you're looking at a CBA, you have to look at long-term effect of the CBA. And I think that was one of the things, even moving forward, Harper, with his last CBA, that Ray Lewis was bringing to the table. It was like, you know, this is a long CBA. You're talking 10 years. Some of you guys won't even make it 2 years. And I think, they, you know, what they did is try to go back and put a patch on that was this way they structured it with the rookies this time. The first 3 years in, your contract is pretty much, you know, non-negotiable, and you have to go into year four and start looking for your money at that point. But I do agree that, you know, it was going to hurt a lot of players in their careers, and you never know how they were going to pan out. You know, I mean, that was cutting them really fast, in my opinion. When you take in consideration, when you look over time, players that have played 10 years, 11 years, you know, some of those players, like Ray Lewis, he probably wouldn't have made it back then, you know, just because of the way it was structured at that time.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and the short-sightedness of, hey, let's get this deal done. We've worked on free agency, and now let's get this cap in place to where we can have some pretty significant numbers to be able to generate to the players. It was all good, and no, I didn't object to any of that. I thought it was an excellent way of maintaining a market to where a small city like Jacksonville or Carolina or New Orleans had the ability to compete with New York or San Francisco or Chicago. Even playing field from a financial standpoint, it's like stock car racing to me, is that you all start with the same amount of money. How you spend it is up to you, but if you want to go over the cap or do, you know, you remember Jack Kent Cook used to spend a tremendous amount of money to bring in guys in Washington. And Al Davis did the same in Oakland. Well, they were kind of penalized for that, in that they couldn't do that anymore. Well, those two clubs are still doing pretty well financially, and everything has worked out to the benefit, which nobody can deny. It's been good. But, again, the ability to have somebody keep his job or lose it because of the amount of money instead of his 40 time, I thought that was a little peculiar. So that was the particulars behind that situation back in 93, and I'm glad you brought it up, but there were a lot of hard feelings during those times.
Yeah, I would imagine so, and we'll swap to maybe happier times and memories. As I know you were there from 91 to 96, correct? I think
yes.
It was. Okay. So you got a chance to play at both Falcon Stadiums, Fulton County Stadium and the Georgia Dome, correct?
I did, yeah.
Kind of, you know, for people that – a lot of us just went to games at those particular places, but kind of compare the two as to what it was like to go from Fulton County in 91 to, you know, in 92 when the Dome opened.
Well, from a fun standpoint, being outdoors, playing on grass – there's nothing like it. It's the way it should be. And I have to admit, my wife, we were newlyweds during 91. We had just got married that summer, and I remember coming off the field in a preseason game, and it was still warm and all that, and she was kind of, you know, her hair had kind of gotten a little puffed out in the humidity and all that, and then I got real close to give her a hug after I saw her, you know, after we shower and were dressed and were allowed to go after the game, and I said, "When did you start smoking?" And she just laughed, and she goes, "Well, the guy in front of me, the guy to the left of me, and the guy to the right of me all smoked, so I didn't have a choice." And she probably had a couple of drops of beer spilled on her. It was a different atmosphere completely. And for those of you that remember those days, you probably have a smile on your face and go, "Yeah, I remember such and such a time." It was a nice little stadium. It wasn't the biggest in the league, but because of that little kind of enclave roof, that kind of it got pretty loud at times, and especially when New Orleans was a town, there were a lot of really interesting moments from a fan perspective. It was a great place to play, and then you go inside this beautiful dome, but it was just a different aura. The lighting was slightly different, and you had cup holders, and it was a quieter first couple of years before the crowd really knew what to do, and we didn't play well for a while. Remember, the Falcons, up until just recently, you'd have one good year. In 91, we go to the playoffs, and then you'd have almost 2 years of back-to-back problems before you turned it around again. But my long-winded answer, sorry about that, but Fulton County was a great place. I really enjoyed it. I played there as a opponent in 1990 when I was with the Eagles, and I liked it. And then as a Falcon, it was just as fun. And then the Georgia Dome has turned into a really great building. It's a shame we're getting rid of it, but especially lately under the Mike Smith era, it has really gotten loud and raucous there, and it's a great place to play right now.
Yeah, definitely. I have fond memories of Fulton County Stadium and the Dome as well. And I guess here in a couple of years, I can reminisce on missing both of them. But kind of while we're talking about the Dome, let me transition. Some of your fellow 92.9 The Gamers, the morning show actually, were kind of throwing it out to people. The Falcons and the Braves are currently looking for sponsors for their new stadiums. Even as kind of a fun thing, or you can have a serious answer. Is there anything in particular you think it should be called?
That's a great question. I haven't seen the design. I know you can go look on it, and I know that they narrowed it down to two, but remember with the Olympics, they kind of made that one building look like a nest. I think with the logo, with the team and all that, if you can call it or make it something that has to do with a bird, you know, if you call it a nest or an enclave or whatever, I don't know. I teased a couple weeks ago. Remember when they had the off-season competition committee? And Rich McKay, oddly enough, you know, the Falcons president is the head of that. And they were thinking about extending the goalposts. And I said on the air once, I go, well, why don't they use lasers? Why don't they have different colored, cool-looking lasers that you can turn on or turn off so people behind the goalposts don't have any type of obstruction at all. You know, just use technology in a way that could be really interesting, not necessarily scientifically savvy, but, you know, just something that's cool and make it even better than what it is right now. You know, a lime green goalpost is, or lime yellow, excuse me, is okay. I don't have a problem with it. Extending it, no big deal. You know, if it makes a call easier for a referee, that's great. But I think that the Falcons, you know, there's going to be enough Wi-Fi in the stadium to microwave small, you know, body parts. So technologically, it's going to be great, state-of-the-art, and it's going to be built to house NCAA championships, both for football and basketball and all kinds of other events and world-class soccer. It will be a first-class facility. So I don't know if we're going to have the ability to just call it something with the Falcons, as it will be a multi-use facility that everybody's going to get to enjoy.
Yeah, I had jokingly, and I'll easily admit it, since one of the morning guys called me out with my Twitter handle, at the Impact 99, I had jokingly said, why not have Krispy Kreme, you know, have it be the Krispy Kreme field, and we could call it the donut hole, because it's a big, round structure. It's more of a you know, where the dome is more of an oval. But I think they took it a little out of context. But, yeah, there's a lot of Atlanta-based companies that I think are going to try to bid for this. I mean, everything from Home Depot to Delta to, I mean, who knows, maybe even Longhorn Steakhouse tries to jump in on this. But we will kind of get to the, I guess, the quarterback portion of the kind of questionnaire here. There was a little guy from Hattiesburg, Mississippi that was a Falcon. He was drafted in 91. He famously got traded later. But you actually got to be on the same team as Brett Favre. What was he like back then?
Well, the first time I sat down and really visited with Brett, it was in our weight room. He was stretching out before a practice, and he had his pads and shoes. He was all laced up and ready to go, but just a T-shirt on. I was pretty much the same, and, you know, just a few minutes before one of our practices. A lot of times I'd like to go in the weight room and real light. I mean, no weight hardly at all, but just kind of stretch out a little bit or do some flies or something like that, just to stretch out my muscles just a tad before I went out there. And Brett was sitting on the ground, and he was in like a figure four position, stretching out his legs. And then he leaned back. And he was wearing one of those Schimmel shirts that, you know, they're kind of cut right about where the ribs are. And when he leaned back, he had this scar on his stomach that was pretty immense. And so, I didn't know anything about it. And I go, dang, Brett, what the heck happened to you? And he goes, what? And I said, you got that big old scar in your stomach. What happened, man? He goes, oh, you didn't know? I was in a pretty bad Jeep accident. I nearly died. I go, you got to be kidding me. When did that happen? He goes, just before my junior year. What? What? Are you kidding me? And it turned out that he lost 27 feet, not inches, 27 feet of his large intestine. And
wow.
He was really lucky to be alive. But not only did he bounce back from that, but he had an okay junior year. But then once he got healthy again, obviously his senior year, he was a phenomenal player. And he gets to the Falcons, and I'll be candid with you guys. I know that a lot of different rumors have been around for what happened, but the truth be told, I just don't think he and Jerry Glanville got along very well. And Jerry had said at one point, we were down in Dallas, and I think you can go to NFL Films and hear it, and Brett's getting ready to play. He wants to go grab his helmet. It's like third or early fourth quarter of a preseason game, and Jerry just says, I'll put our equipment manager in before I put you in, Favre. Brett just didn't make a real positive impression. And as much as he did both before and after the Falcons, I think that Jerry and he hit on a different cylinder with one another, to kind of coin an engine phrase, and they just didn't click right. And Jerry wanted a different personality, and you had Chris Miller, who was an all-pro. We brought in Wade Wilson. We had Billy Joe Tolliver, and then Brett was really the odd man out. Because he was a high draft pick, you know, he made the team and everything, but he wasn't going to get to play. He just wasn't. And there's more to it, but Brett, you know, didn't take care of himself very well, and he stayed out late and was late to meetings, and he was not in our team picture go look at the 91. He was late. He stayed out the night before and didn't show up while everyone else was getting the photos taken. So long story short, the business decision was we got a second-round draft pick in Brett Favre, and we can trade for a number one draft pick with the Packers because they wanted him in a bad way. And long story short, they made the trade, and Dan Majkowski goes down about six or seven games into that season, and the rest is history, the Hall of Fame history. But Brett's career here in Atlanta, unfortunately for us, just didn't pan out the way that anyone would have wanted. And obviously great things for him in Green Bay, but, you know, that's part of my recollection of it. Coach, you see it any other way?
No, I don't. Actually, with Brett going to Green Bay, it probably saved his career considering what was happening at that time. As you know, being that you've been in Green Bay, it is a very small place, and there's no place to get in trouble. So while you're in Green Bay, you either have to go to Milwaukee or Chicago, and after you do that trip twice at best, you realize that that's no fun, and trying to make it back in time. So I think that, you know, the trade, I agree with you, I think the trade was down to the fact that those elements made it easy for Atlanta to make the move, and also getting what they were going to get on the top end, which was a number one pick for a number two, was a no-brainer for them. But I guess, you know, hindsight being 2020, you look back at it now, you go, wow, you know, had he stayed in Atlanta, what would they have turned into?
Yeah. And throw in this, remember, when he goes to Green Bay, brand-new coach in Mike Holmgren, Ron Wolf, who was the general manager there, and Ken Harrock, the Falcons' general manager, those guys are best friends. They're best friends, and they talk to each other all the time, and we picked up Vinny Clark and Lester Archambault, and George Kuntz went there. There's a lot of different Falcon and Packer players that went back and forth because those two guys were such good friends, both on and off the professional ranks. And Ron really wanted, the Packers really wanted Brett the year before when he was drafted, and they didn't get him. The Falcons selected right before then, and Ron teased Kenny, goes, doggone it, Ken, I wanted that guy. I thought you were going to take Brownie Nagel. And, you know, history will show that it was a real close decision the Falcons made. But eventually the Packers got their man. And I can still see, and, Coach, you may remember this. I vividly remember, Jeremy, maybe you too, when Brett went in and he first started playing, that he would throw a perfectly executed touchdown to Sterling Sharp, and then about three plays later, he'd throw a ball as good as you can to one of the Minnesota Vikings or the Chicago Bears, and you just see Mike Holmgren wince and turn his head and say things under his breath that no man would ever want to utter in front of family or friends. But he tried the patience tremendously before they ended up making a run for it. You know, you bring in Chimura and Frank Winters and Reggie White and a few of those other guys, and you built a pretty good team around him that obviously, truth be told, is they were Super Bowl champions for a number of reasons. But he struggled there mightily at first, and he was struggling with us. So his early part of his career wasn't all, you know, Hall of Fame and glory down to Canton, Ohio. There were some thorns on that rose.
And it's funny you brought up the thing about the team pick. It may have actually been you that I heard say it, that I had heard the story before, and then it may have been you that confirmed it on 92.9 over the weekend or something like that. But, yeah, a lot of people don't know that, and it's kind of to add more to his allure. A lot of people don't know who actually picked him up from the airport in Green Bay. It was a guy that was working under Holmgren who had been friends with him since Holmgren's previous job. And it happened to be one John Gruden that actually picked up this guy. And he kept going, Mike, why are we getting this guy? He's awful. You're not going to like him. Mike says, I don't care. Put him in the car and bring him here.
Yep, the interesting part of and Mark Brunell was there in Green Bay.
Yep.
And there was a couple other guys that ended up having pretty amazing careers in the NFL, and they couldn't make it with the Packers. You know, it was just an amazing time. Coach, I think you were going to say something. I probably interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, I was just about to say that what Jeremy was about to talk about was a story. You know, it's just kind of funny how all of those individuals ended up right there and what their careers turned out to be as a result of this, you know, coming together in Green Bay.
Yeah,
you know, I played
with
Reggie in Atlanta, and when he we called it the Reggie White Victory Tour. You know, like when the Jackson 5 went on that tour, and they made all kinds of money. And Reggie went from San Francisco, and he came to Atlanta. The Eagles had made an offer to try to keep him, and then he went to Green Bay. And because I knew and played with Reggie in Atlanta, they invited me to attend a dinner along with Taylor Smith and Jerry Glanville and some others. And I was there for a little while, and, you know, when they started talking business, I realized it was time for me to bow out of the conversation. But Reggie made a comment when he signed with the Packers. And one of them was, well, God told me to do this, and I understand Reggie's faith, and don't question that at all. But one of the first things that he said was, there's a quarterback here that I really believe in, and I think he's going to take this team places. So, and if you remember, they had a very strong relationship, Reggie and Brett. They did a commercial together for Edge shaving gel, and I tell you what, it was one of the funniest commercials I've ever seen. I don't buy Edge because of it, but I buy Edge because I love that commercial at times, and I will always remember that about those two. It was they got along like they had been long-lost brothers, and they understood each other, they respected each other, and they learned to win together. And for obvious reasons, you know, that Super Bowl ring, nobody can ever take that stuff away from them. They were a very special team.
Well, and as we get into more quarterback talk, two guys that you're familiar with as you played with them in Atlanta pretty well, Chris Miller and Jeff George. Just going to kind of get your take on what it was like to play with them or to interact with them, and if the reputations they gathered were really who they were, or were they kind of, you know, misjudged a little bit.
Well, Chris is a guy that I really gained a lot of respect for him. Coming here in 91, Michael Haynes was already here, and Andre Risen. We had Mike Pritchard. We brought in Drew Hill from Houston. And so he had a couple of really solid receivers to throw to. But there was one particular drill that we had, and I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with it. Please forgive me if I'm taking a long time with this. But you'd have a seven-step drop from the quarterback. And then what he would do is our drill was from the middle of the field or the left or the right hash mark. It didn't matter. Let's say we were throwing to the right-hand side. We'd put a trash can 2 yards from the sideline, 44 yards away from where the ball was snapped. So let's say the ball is on the 20-yard line. You take 44 yards there, so what is that, the 36-yard line on the other side, and put a trash can. And instead of having receivers run that 44 yards, we just knew Michael. When Chris hit his seventh step and threw the ball as far as he could, he knew where Mike was going to be 44 yards down the field. And that little drill, and really you'd miss the can, and then Billy Joe would hit it, and he'd just celebrate as if he had won an Olympic gold medal. And then Chris would try real hard to do it, and then he'd hit the trash can. And it was really just target practice. And we got so good at that. And if you remember, Michael Haynes' numbers were off the chart this year. Nobody could guard him deep. And you always knew he was going to go deep, but when he went short, he set up the deep pass, and what do you have, 17 TD receptions that year. It was phenomenal. And you got Andre on the other side. You got Pritchard and Drew Hill up the middle. We were really tough to stop. And Chris ended up getting hit in the head a couple times and signed as a free agent with the Rams, and everything, you know, went for him pretty positively for a while. But, gosh, what a – he wasn't – a leader per se. He wasn't going to grab you by the face mask or anything like that, but he was one of those guys that when he was in the huddle, it was his, and he controlled it. Not the same way that Jim McMahon would, for example. You know, I played with Jim in Philadelphia, but appreciative nonetheless, aggressive nonetheless, and very competent. So real fond memories. And I know Chris was coaching recently in Arizona. He was with Ken Wisenhunt and that staff, but obviously they've been fired since then. But, you know, Chris is a real cerebral guy, and I know he's been around the league for a while and doing real well. Nothing but great things to say about C-Mill.
Yeah, quick little tidbit about Chris Miller. When I was younger, We won't say how young. We don't want to date any of us enjoying the show today. But my mom and a couple other people, we were in line at this place to get Dave Justice of the Atlanta Braves autograph. Now that I'm older, I can look at it and go, gosh, this was at least a three-hour line around this parking lot, and it was hot and everything like that, and we're like maybe a third of the way through the line, and we see somebody get out a table, a guy sit down, and some guys in suits just kind of stand behind them. And we kind of look, and they're like, hey, this is the Falcons quarterback Chris Miller, if you'd like to see him. I look at my mom, and I'm like, we can see Dave Justice another time, so... We go and meet Chris, and I still have the signed picture to this day. It's one of the oldest autographs I ever had, and from that time on, he was like one of my favorite guys all the way up till he left even.
Well, that's a great story, and I appreciate you sharing that. He was not the most publicly appreciated figure in Atlanta, but a real personable guy. I would always tease Chris because he never had a hair out of place. He was always touching his hair when he didn't have a helmet on and making sure it was just right, you know. And just, you know, little stuff that you hey, Chris, is one right over your left ear. And he'd look at you like, what? No, you got a hair out of place. And he'd really react like, holy cow, I got to go look get in front of a mirror. But other than that, I mean, fun guy to be around and obviously a talented quarterback. And that – run-and-shoot offense that we had, he wasn't a scrambler at all, but a lot of times he'd set up in between the guard and tackle, either the right or the left side, so he had a little bit of movement in him. And remember, we didn't use a tight end back then, so we only had five guys blocking for him, and usually a defense would try to disrupt us by bringing six or occasionally bringing seven. So his ability to extend a play or just get rid of the ball and get it to one of the receivers when a blitz was coming was critical, and more times than not, he was able to do it, and he got pounded pretty hard a few times because there would always be somebody that was unblocked that would come in and hit him and knock him down, and every time he gets up, and later in his career, he did have some concussion issues, and it cut his career short, but I just think he had a tough time matching, even with Isaac Bruce and Holt and some of the great receivers that the Rams had. He never quite had the chemistry with those guys as he did with Michael Haynes and with Andre Rison and the guys he played with here in Atlanta.
And then the other guy I mentioned, Jeff George, that you got an opportunity to play with. My take from him always was that maybe he was a little more aggressive, possibly even with his personality, than he might have rubbed people the wrong way sometimes, but he had a cannon for an arm.
I still remember, and if you'll allow the quick story, our first practice once Jeff signed with the club, and we're doing some training camp stuff where it was, we had our pads on, but there was no defense, or at least not one yet. And he started warming up and throwing some balls, and just you know, no big deal. First day, we didn't want to overdo it, I guess. And warms up, throwing a couple of out routes, and then a post, and no big deal. And then they bring the defense over, and they did one-on-one drills. And it was just a cornerback and a wide receiver. And I think it was Bert Emanuel. And he ran, he just looked over at Jeff, and he gave a little nod, and Jeff gave him one. They knew what the route was. The cornerback didn't know. Set Hutt, the... Just those two guys are going, Jeff drops back, and Bert runs a go route, just a straight, it's called a nine, right? He's just running as fast as he can, and he gave a little fake at about 10 or 12 yards and earned just a little bit of separation. And Jeff threw the ball on his fifth step, and it was one of the most beautiful passes I've ever seen in my life, and it was so easy to catch. That was the thing, and Bert just keeps streaking down the field, and as fast as he was, and he breaks away from the corner at about 35, 40 yards, catches the ball and just keeps going and just kind of goes, woo-hoo-hoo! And everyone on offense, just their jaw dropped. And Mouse Davis was our offensive coordinator, and he says, fellas, I think we just found ourselves a quarterback. And that was the start. But his arm was phenomenal. We don't have enough time to go into everything. It wasn't perfect, unfortunately. It didn't work out with playoff wins and, you know, long-term deals, but Jeff definitely did have a body on him that without question, was what you would want from any quarterback. He could make any pass, long, short, in between. There were some other issues that got in the way, and we won't discuss those now, but, you know, all the promise in the world, and we were delighted when we got him, and we thought it was going to be the thing that would take us over the top.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I always enjoyed watching those two play, as they were some of the more prominent ones that I actually got to see up close. But real quickly, as we're in the last few minutes of the show here, you've kind of teased before on and off, since you played for Jerry Glanville and June Jones. Real quickly, maybe a good story that you can actually repeat on live radio about one or the other of them.
Well, I'll do one I haven't done before. Real quick, you know, Jerry had a big affinity for music, and I got to meet James Brown, Travis Tritt, Bonnie Raitt, John Cougar. He was friends with a lot of different bands and people within them, and there's kind of a connection between music and playing in front of a lot of live audience and professional sports. You're in front of a live audience. And if you do a good job, you get cheered, and a lot of times in football you get booed. You don't really get booed a lot if you do a bad song, because you really don't do many of them, but there's a correlation there. And Jerry loved music, and the musicians loved coming to the games, and we got to meet a lot of different people. Well, we talked about Fulton County a little while ago, and there's this guy at Fulton County Stadium early in the year, and if you remember, early in the year, the pitcher's mound was left in place. So it
right.
was still there, and the infield was still dirt. And there's this guy, and he's got jet white hair, and he's got these really long Elvis sideburns, and he's standing on the pitcher's mound watching the game. And I didn't know who it was, so I go up to our equipment manager, Whitey Zimmerman. I go, "Hey, Whitey, who's that guy standing up on the pitcher's mound?" And he says, "I don't know. I've seen him there the whole ball game. It's almost halftime, and he's been there since we got here. I don't know who it is." "Doggone, I don't either, Whitey." So I go up to Pat Chafee, who was running back there. "Pat, who's that guy?" "I don't know." Go up to Andre Rison. "Hey, do you know who that guy is?" "Man, I don't know who that is at all. I've been watching him the whole game." Well, a few plays go by. Our offense comes off the field, and Chris Miller and Billy Joe Tolliver are talking about some plays. And when they're done, I go, "Hey, Freckle Red," his nickname, Billy's nickname was Freckle. And so I said, "Who's that guy standing over there on top of the pitcher's mound?" He goes, "Good Lord, son, that's George Jones, father of country music." Just like that. So
wow.
I said, "George Jones, heaven to – okay." So I go back over to Whitey Zimmerman, and Whitey, I go, "Hey, do you know who George Jones is?" He goes, "That's exactly who it is. I was thinking, that's George – I love George Jones." I said, "Whitey, you got a hat or something that I could get? You got a T-shirt?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, hold on a second." So he goes into his bag of tricks that he has on the sideline. He grabs a Falcon hat. I go over and get a ball. And I go over to Mr. Jones. I said, "Sir, I don't know you. My name's Harper LaBelle, and really glad you're here. I wanted to make sure you had a hat, and the team wanted to give you one of these. This is a game ball now. This is a game ball."
Yeah.
And he goes, he held it like a baby in his hands. He goes, "Son, that's the nicest thing you could ever done for me. Thank you very much." And so I walk away, and halftime goes on. We go in the tunnel. We come back out, and there's George standing on top of the pitcher's mound watching the – he's too small. He couldn't see over the players. So he had to look on from the pitcher's mound. And I noticed the ball wasn't there. So about the middle of the third quarter, I walk back over. "Mr. Jones, did security or did someone take that ball away from you? Do you need me to get you another one?" He goes, "No, son, that's in my car. My limo driver's got it right there. I can't thank you and Jerry enough for inviting me. I've had a blast. What a great game. I've really enjoyed this." And Jerry just did stuff like that. He had friends in and outside of football, and he had friends in different businesses, and he just was able to extend it beyond just football in a way that a lot of people were irritated with. I never was. I just thought he was taking full advantage of the situation rather than letting the situation take full advantage of him. But that's just one of, you know, a number of different things that we used to have happen back in those crazy days. Evander Holyfield was in our locker room all the time. Hammer, MC Hammer, came on a trip to San Francisco with us. I mean, Jerry kind of made it a real open invitation for a lot of different celebrities.
Wow, so not only were you a player rep for the Falcons, but you were the ambassador to country music stars.
Not just country. Like I said, Hammer was probably in his heyday with Too Legit to Quit. Remember?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was huge back in our locker room back in those days.
Yeah, yeah. The Biebers and the Ushers of the world wish they had hits like that, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if you had a pair of those baggy gym pants like everybody was wearing back in the day and a pair of Reeboks. I think you did.
No, I can safely say that I did not. My mom was good enough to me to not buy me those pants and to inform me that if I wanted high-priced shoes that I could earn them myself.
Well, maybe Coach had a little bit of, a different hairstyle back in those days, maybe. We all were a little different back in the late 80s early 90s.
Yeah, I must have that I did have some of those pants.
Now, do you still have those pants, Coach?
Absolutely not.
Oh, you got to keep them around now. They're probably worth their weight in gold now. All the young kids relish that kind of stuff. Hey, tell me you didn't wear a pair of those bike coaching shorts, those real tidy whitey brand that just barely covered half your thighs.
No, sir, I did not.
Oh, good for you. You're a good man.
We had a ball.
Pair of black Rydell shoes with white socks that, what did they call it, shin socks or whatever. They did just above your ankle and a pair of those bike coaching shorts that were in whatever your team color was.
Yeah, absolutely, with the sponge foam hat.
Thank you. That and a wide lapel collared shirt that was too tight.
Exactly.
It's medium.
Oh, and the Zubaz pants as well that got very popular.
Thank you. I have a pair of old Zubaz. They gave them out when I was in Philly, but the equipment manager charged us for them regardless. That was a crazy time.
Wow, but as much fun as we had, we have to call it a day for now. Harper, we appreciate you coming on and reminiscing and weighing in on the Falcons season, and look forward to having you on again very soon.
Well, appreciate it. Heywood Hart, sorry if I took all your time today.
Oh, you did. It was wonderful. Y'all, I just wanted to hear all of the stories that you had.
Well,
fun times. I appreciate it.
Well, for the Coach Heywood Hill, I am your host, Jeremy York. And once again, thanks, Harper, for coming on. We'll see you guys next week.